And I think we're ready for verse 17, if I made my stopping place note at the right place. We are in the second round of speeches. In chapter 21, Job is responding to the speech of Zophar. In chapter 20, in the verses preceding verse 17, Job has been asking some very serious questions. You recall we discussed the fact that the thesis of the friends is that sin produces suffering. And as a result of that, they conclude that suffering proves sin. And from that they conclude that since Job is suffering, Job is a sinner. And Job has been asking them, particularly in verses 7 to 16, if that is true, then how do you account for the prosperity of the wicked that we observe in the world? In verses 17 through about verse 22, the friends have a fallback position. And that is, well, you account for that because maybe God isn't going to get them until He deals with their children. And He may let some of those folks get by with it, but once they're gone, He's going to zap their kids. And so that's their backup position, and Job addresses that beginning in verse 17. Before we begin that discussion, let's bow together for a word of prayer. When the friends of Job take the position that the wicked do not prosper, as we've suggested, Job says, not so. The wicked do indeed prosper. And he describes some of their prosperity in the verses immediately preceding verse 17. The friends, of course, have a couple of responses. We talked about one we'll see here in a moment. But one of their responses is, well, they may prosper, but not for long, because God is going to take care of it. So that raises a question in Job's mind that he addresses to them beginning in verse 17. And that's the question, how often? You see, Job is suggesting now, you say they don't prosper, I say they do, you say not long. Well, let's just see if we can't put this to some kind of empirical test. Let's just, as we would say today, get Mr. Barna or Mr. Gallup, and we'll let them go out and take a scientific poll and let them establish how often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in His anger? Are they as straw before the wind and like chaff which the storm carries away? To ask the question is to answer it, because Job and his friends can look out into the world and they can observe all kinds of people who by any standard are wicked, and yet who though by any standard they are wicked are prosperous. So Job said, just how often? You just look out there and point it out to me. You say God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons? You see what they've said when Job says how often? And they say, well, it may not look like what we're saying is true if you put it through an empirical test, but just wait a generation. Because God will get the kids, and that's where He'll take care of them. God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Let God repay him so that he may know it. If punishment is delayed, Job considers this to be an encouragement to sin, an encouragement to depravity. Because these guys are going to say, well, yeah, what difference does it make to me? Let me eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow, God may get my kids. You see, that is no deterrent at all to their wickedness. And Job considers that to be an encouragement to depravity. You know, what do these kids, what do these folks, this kind of person, what do they care about what happens to their children? They don't care at all. Let his own eyes see decay, and let him drink the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care for his household after him when the number of his months is cut off? It just doesn't bother him at all. He's gone to the grave. So, whatever happens to the kids, tough break. Verse 22, Job sort of checks himself with the confession that God's ways are inscrutable, and that God judges everybody. It doesn't make any difference how exalted they may be. Can anyone teach God knowledge? God's ways are past. We can't teach God anything. In that he judges those on high, those who are exalted, those who are lifted up. God is above them all, and he judges them all. And then Job closes this part of his discussion by suggesting that when you really look at life, and this addresses the thesis of the friends, that suffering indicates sin, prosperity indicates goodness. Suffering indicates God's displeasure, prosperity indicates God's pleasure. Job says, you know, you look at life and you really can't discern any pattern out there. There is no real basis upon which to reach the conclusions that you have reached. You look at life and you see moral differences. But the moral differences that you see cannot explain the diversities of fortune that you see between those who are blessed and those who are not, those who suffer and those who don't, nor can it explain their common fate. And their common fate is death. Look at how he expresses it. Verses 23 to 26. One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat, and the marrow of his bones is moist. While another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. There's the pattern. You can't really tell much by it. One dies in the strength of life, with blessings all around him. One dies in bitterness, never having even tasted that which is good. But then what happens to them both? Together, they lie down in the dust, and worms cover them. Isn't that true? As Pat tells the story of the fellow who died, how much did he leave? He left it all. And this is illustrated, I think, by the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, if indeed it is a parable, which I personally doubt, but it's called that. The rich man and Lazarus both died. The rich man reminds you here of the one who dies in full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied, sides filled out with fat, the marrow of his bones is moist. Lazarus, while another dies with a bitter soul, never having tasted anything good. Remember what the Scripture says about them. Together, they lie down in the dust. The biggest difference was that of the rich man, it says, and the rich man died and was buried. He had a fancy funeral. He had the big black hearse, followed by the big black limousine, followed by the long line of cars, and in that day, the paid professional mourners. And the poor old Lazarus, it just says, and he died. Don't know what happened to the body, but we do know what happened to the soul. And was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. So Job looks at it and he says, fellas, you can't tell anything from what you see out here in the world. You can't make those judgments based upon who suffers and who doesn't, who's prospered and who doesn't. They have the same end. They have the same finality. As a matter of fact, Job is convinced that the thinking of the friends is so erroneous that it can only be motivated by malice. Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me. It is not just an incidental wrong that he's talking about now. It's not just a wrong that is something that cannot be helped based upon their theology. He's saying, fellas, I know what you're thinking. You're planning the wrong that you would do to me. For you say, where is the house of the nobleman, and where is the tent, the dwelling places of the wicked? Now, even though the accusations of these folks, these friends, rarely come out into the open, but we'll see some of it start to come out in the open more plainly as we proceed. The inference of these folks is very, very clear and obvious. And that is, Job, you are a sinner. You're getting your just desserts. You're getting what you deserve to get. Now, Zophar, you'll recall, has already appealed to the universe of knowledge. Why? Everybody knows that. We've talked about it. And Job has responded to that. He does respond to it. And he's got a pretty cute response here. Zophar has said, if you go back to chapter 20 and verse 4, I believe it is, do you know, don't you know this from of old, from the establishment of man on earth? Everybody, it's been around a long time. Ask anybody, anywhere. And Job basically says, Zophar, if that's the information you picked up from being around, then Zophar, you hadn't been around very much. You hadn't traveled very far. You hadn't learned very much. If you just go out, Job says, and just pick out at random any wayfaring man, anybody who has been anywhere, and I think by implication maybe anybody who knows anything, you'd find out that what you're saying is not true and does not comport with human experience. Have you not asked the wayfaring man? And do you not recognize their witness? For the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. And basically, what Job is saying here is not that the day of calamity is coming for them, but he's saying, when the day of calamity comes, they will be reserved. They will be spared. And isn't that the experience that we have? I mean, after all, when the day of calamity comes, who gets along best? The good, honest person who doesn't have very much? Or the evil, wicked person who has laid by in store, who has said, I will tear down my barns and I will build greater barns. I will insure against this. I will insure against that. And who can get his advisors around him and take precautions to prevent the day of calamity. Job says, when the day of calamity comes, they're going to be reserved, set aside. Reserved there is sort of like a recipe. That you go along and it says you do this, you do that, you do the other, and then you reserve something for later use. And that's what's happening to the righteous here. I mean to the unrighteous. They're being reserved, spared from the day of calamity. And in addition to that, the day of fury, they will be led forth so that they miss the day of fury, led forth away from it, out of it, protected from it. And in addition to that, who will confront him with his actions? Who is going to be man enough to get up in his face and say, you are wicked and you are wrong. Not many folks. And I'm inclined to think that in most instances you could take the M off of many. Not any folks are going to rise up in his face. Oh, you call me wicked? Well, let me show you. Miss your head? It's gone. Who will confront him with his actions? And who will repay him for what he has done? Who's going to take him to court? Who's going to challenge the rightness of what he's done? Even in death. When we have this common end here, where they both go down to the dust and the worms cover them. Even in death, the wicked man has the advantage. While he is carried to the grave, men will watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. He's got the big funeral parade. How then, Job concludes, will you vainly comfort me? For your answers are full of falsehood. Guys, I have taken what you have said, and I have put it to the test, and at every turn you have been found to be false. So how do you think that these false words, these lies that you have been telling about me and about God, are going to comfort me at all? That concludes the second round of speeches. The third round of speeches starts here in chapter 22. We haven't heard from Eliphaz in a while. It's Eliphaz's turn again. Eliphaz, when you start looking at the friends, may well be the best of the three. There does not appear to be any great malice in either his voice or in his words. There's going to be a great deal of what he says that is going to ring sort of true. But he just got one big problem. Well, maybe more than one. But at least one. And that is, he has never looked at, he has never tried to see, he has never been interested in seeing Job's problem through Job's eyes. Now we have an expression, a very favorite expression. I see some heads nodding. We know what's coming, don't we? Well, if I were she, or if we're face to face, if I were you, isn't it amazing how good we are at solving everybody else's problems? We've got just the right answer, don't we? We've got just the right solution. It makes no difference how oversimplified we make it. Zophar's problem is he has never looked at Job's problem through Job's eyes. And as he continues here, we see a little progression from cycle to cycle to cycle of speeches. In the first cycle of speeches, Job's friends have their position. We all know what it is. But they speak primarily in generalizations, and they don't really directly apply it to Job. Now, there are plenty of inferences, and they indirectly certainly apply their generalizations to Job, but they speak in generalizations. When they get to the second cycle of speeches, their theme, as we have seen, is the fate of the wicked. And Job's view that that is not so, that their view of the fate of the wicked is not correct, comes into open contradiction with these friends in the second cycle of speeches. But when we come to the third cycle of speeches, what the friends had previously inferred now comes out into the open. And we'll see Eliphaz saying, look here, Job, it's no longer an inference, it's no longer an implication. It's something that is specifically directed toward Job. And when this happens, the breach between Job and his friends is complete. And as is so often the case, when the breach is complete, dialogue and discussion breaks down. There isn't much more room to talk. There isn't much more reason to talk. And we will see that in this third cycle of speeches. Eliphaz gives the longest here in chapter 22, 30 verses long. Job responds, Bildad has been pretty well shut down. In chapter 25, he's able to work up six more verses. And he is through. And Zophar just disappears from the scene. He doesn't even have a third speech. He is already through. Now, as we will see, that doesn't mean all the talking is over. Because we will discover that while the talking has been going on, there has been a young man sitting over to the side. And he has been listening to what is going on. His name is Elihu. And he's going to come swaggering on the scene and say, I thought as a young man I ought to be quiet and let older and wiser heads carry the day. But you fellows have been an abysmal failure. Now let me tell you how the cow ate the cabbage. And Elihu, out of the wisdom of youth, begins to solve all of the problems of life and of Job. But let's look and see what Eliphaz has to say here in his speech in the third round of speeches. He brings Job face to face with his sin. That's verses 2 down through verse 11. He pays a tribute to the greatness of God and some related things in verses 12 to 20. And he makes a final appeal to Job to repent, 21 through 30. Then Eliphaz the Temanite responded, Can a vigorous man be of use to God, or a wise man be useful to himself? Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous, or prophet if you make your ways perfect? Is it because of your reverence that he reproves you, that he enters into judgment against you? Now, what do you find wrong in those verses? Isn't that pretty orthodox? Everything he's saying there. Isn't what Eliphaz is saying here really a statement of the self-sufficiency of God? And isn't that the kind of God that we serve, a very self-sufficient God, the I am that I am, no beginning, no end? Omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. What can you add? Well, if that is the case, and if it's just an orthodox statement of the self-sufficiency of God, where does Eliphaz go wrong? Does he go wrong? Eliphaz's problem is that when he starts talking about the self-sufficiency of God, he does so in a manner that apparently makes God so transcendent, so otherworldly, so far above and beyond us, that this God simply cannot take any interest in or be concerned about at all his creation or his creatures. God doesn't care. God cannot be bothered with you and with me. Do you think you're going to be of some use to God? Do you think that God is pleased? Can you affect the emotions of God? Any pleasure if you're righteous? Or is it of any benefit? Is it of any profit to God if you make your ways perfect? You see, religion to Eliphaz was worth no more than somehow weaning us away from these sticky emotional problems that we have on earth. You would think maybe he was influenced by some Eastern religions, because that's one of their prime characteristics, is let's just develop in people this kind of stoical attitude that takes neither pleasure in that which is good nor pain in that which is evil. And we'll just make them sort of dispassionate people, sort of like God is. God is dispassionate. God is indifferent. So you see, his orthodox statement is really unorthodox. His orthodox statement is really wrong, because those of us who are able to see behind the scenes here know that God does care, and that God does love, and that God does take pleasure in the righteous. And indeed, that's what set this whole chain of events in motion. Because God took pleasure in Job. And when Satan came strutting in and said, let me ask you, tell me, God, any of those folks out there really serve you because they love you? Any of those folks out there really serve you because of you and your nature and who you are and what you are? Don't they really serve you, God, because you pour out blessings upon them for that service? And if you take that away, won't they really just curse you and die? And God took pleasure in Job. Have you considered my servant Job? God's pleasure in Job set it all in motion. God is not dispassionate. God is not unconcerned. And while Job could not do it, you and I can. You and I can look at the cross. And anybody who can call God dispassionate and otherworldly and unconcerned in light of the cross has a heart that makes granite look like a marshmallow. God is love. That is His nature. As much as is omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence. Eliphaz thought he knew God. In fact, I suggest to you that Eliphaz thought he was really speaking for God. And in the end of this book, we're going to hear God speak. And you recall this statement here, and you remember how different what God says is from what God was expected to say. You and I need to listen to what God says, not what He may be expected to say or what we wish He had said. In verses 5 through 11, Eliphaz more openly and more bluntly brands Job as a sinner than any of the friends had dared do before. Now keep in mind that these friends had never really been able up to this point to lay any sin to the charge of Job. You recall we talked about the fact that they even as much as admitted that. Because when Job finally started speaking, they said, "Oh, Job, we got you now. Thy speech condemns thee." Listen to this arrogant man here who dares say that he is upright and righteous. Got you now, Job. But not a one of their charges. None of them had ever laid a charge against Job that was based upon any kind of oppression of the poor or robbing of the widows or anything of that nature. But Eliphaz does here. Now, between the time that the friends came and this present moment, where has Job been? Has he been on his horse, riding across the country with his army behind him? To raid, slaughter, rob, pillage? No. He's been sitting on an ash heap. And if what he says of himself is true, and it is, he had too many sores and too many spots to do too much sitting on a saddle. Job had been in the ash heap covered with sores, scraping himself with a piece of broken pottery. Now, where then do these charges come from? These fellows have been sitting right there with Job, talking to him, trying to convince him what a sinner he was and why all this stuff had happened to him. Job hadn't done anything else. They had no more sources of information. That leads me to conclude that the charges that Eliphaz makes here directly against Job are nothing more than pure slander. That's pretty serious, isn't it, to slander the friends of God? Matter of fact, I'm just going to stop here and go preaching. Happens every day. And Bob will take up there next Lord's Day morning. Lord willing, Millie and I are going to be sharing a birthday weekend with some grandsons over in Louisiana. If I have been washed in the blood, and because I have been washed in the blood, God, through and because of Jesus Christ, considers me blameless. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute iniquity. If we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, His Son, goes on cleansing us from our sins. If you have been washed in the blood, and if God considers you blameless, isn't it imperative upon me that I consider you in the same way? How dare I? How dare anybody? Lay anything to the charge of God's elect. Now, that's not to suggest that we are not sinners. That is not to suggest that you and I do not need to work together, and when you see me go astray, you come and take me by the hand and lead me back. But it is to suggest, good people, that when we do it in the spirit of bearing one another's burdens and so fulfilling the law of Christ, and not as somebody who seems to take pleasure in iniquity and say, "Oh, look at so-and-so, boy, is he or she really bad?" I think you get what I'm talking about. If God considers His children blameless, shouldn't we not be more loving and considerate? Go back, if you will. Look at some of God's friends in the Old Testament. Look at Abraham. Abraham perfect? Well, Abraham got ahead of God's plan. Messed things up for everybody for a long, long time. Still going on. Abraham went off down into Egypt and gave his wife to two different men and lied about it. Come over in the New Testament and read about Abraham and see how many negative statements you find about his faith. David? How does murder and adultery sound? How does a man after God's own heart sound? We need to be careful how we treat, think about, talk about the friends of God. And we need to be sure, beyond the shade of a shadow of an intimation of a doubt, that we are one of His friends. Second bell. Sermon ended, Sunday school over. Bible starts there next Lord's Day. Thank you for your presence and your attention this morning.